This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, October 22nd, 2012. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, ahead of the final presidential debate, activists press the candidates to address the U.S. drone program abroad and the war in Afghanistan. We'll look at a same-sex marriage initiative in Maryland, and Noam Chomsky visits the Gaza Strip. We'll hear his perspectives on the Israeli blockade of the territory and the pursuit of statehood at the UN. Those stories and more coming up after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR in headlines. At least 7 people died and dozens were wounded today as gun battles continued in the Lebanese capital and in the northern coastal town of Tripoli. Jackson Allers has more from Beirut.
Tensions grew Sunday as the funeral procession of Lebanese intelligence chief Brigadier General Wissam al-Hassan took place in downtown Beirut with thousands in attendance. Al-Hassan, a highly vocal supporter of the Syrian opposition, was blown up by a car bomb on Friday. 2 others also died and dozens more were wounded. The worst of the fighting today was in Tripoli, where clashes are common between Sunni Muslims backing the Syrian insurgency and the Alawites who back the regime of Bashar al-Assad. The violence is feeding fears of a more serious civil conflict in Lebanon, which has not fully overcome its own sectarian divisions since the devastating 1975 to 1990 civil war, which claimed more than 250,000 lives. The Lebanese army has pledged to quell the current violence, and a sweeping manhunt is underway to find the perpetrators of the assassination. Jackson Allers, FSRN, Beirut, Lebanon.
A federal court granted a temporary stay of execution to a mentally ill Florida death row inmate who was scheduled to die tomorrow. Janelle Irwin reports.
The decision followed a ruling by the Florida Supreme Court that let stand a determination that John Ferguson is sane. But Ferguson was diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic before he committed his first crime. In the early 1970s, he was deinstitutionalized against the advice of doctors. Ferguson was convicted of killing 8 people during a home invasion in 1977. In a separate case, he was found guilty of murdering 2 teenagers. He's been on death row since 1978. A district judge ruled that the death row inmate's delusions were genuine. His attorneys say Ferguson believes he will be resurrected after death. State rulings held that his beliefs were consistent with Christian views and therefore rational. Mark Elliott, executive director of Floridians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, hopes the stay of execution will stick.
Trying to execute this extremely mentally ill man is not only beneath us, it's pointless. It's probably costing Florida taxpayers millions of dollars, and it does nothing to solve violent crimes or prevent violent crimes from happening to Floridians in the first place.
The Federal Appeals Court will hear the case on Friday. Janelle Irwin, FSRN, Tampa.
Clear Channel is taking down voter fraud billboards that critics say were actually voter intimidation billboards. The giant signs threatening jail time and hefty fines for fraudulent voting were put up in largely minority neighborhoods in swing states Ohio and Wisconsin. The company says the signs violated their policy against anonymous political ads and that the unnamed family foundation that paid for them opted to take them down rather than add their name. Workers at a New York City car wash voted to unionize over the weekend. They're the second group of car wash workers to do so in recent months. Salim Rizvi reports.
After months of organizing, workers at the Webster Car Wash in the Bronx voted Saturday in favor of joining the Retail, Wholesale and Department Store Union, or the RWDSU. The New York City car wash workers have been trying for past several months to organize for better wages and working conditions. Tamara Martin is with the RWDSU.
The next step is for our representatives to come to the negotiating table with management. And through that process, we'll hope to achieve a better working standard for these individuals plus better wages.
Most of these workers are recent immigrants and have limited education and language skills. Some complain that they have been forced to work for long hours without safe working conditions and adequate wages. Salim Rizvi, FSR in New York City.
Prominent American Indian activist Russell Means is dead. Means was the first national director of the American Indian Movement, or AIM, and was central to the 1973 occupation at Wounded Knee. The Oglala Sioux was also a writer, an actor, and a politician. In 1987, he sought the Libertarian U.S. presidential nomination, finishing second. In 1992, Means explained why he did not support the tribal council system set up by the U.S. government.
They make it in the white man's world by walking backwards, stooped over, begging for his money. And yet, the statistics of our deprivation remain constant. Since World War II, they have remained constant. You know, we have eight-year-olds back home and on other reservations that commit suicide. Eight-year-olds, for Christ's sakes!
Means died of esophageal cancer at his ranch on South Dakota's Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. For FSRN from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Doran Marina in Los Angeles. President Barack Obama and challenger Mitt Romney meet in Boca Raton, Florida for their final debate tonight, which will mainly focus on foreign policy. The topics, which moderator Bob Schieffer has already announced, include red lines for Iran's nuclear program, America's longest war in Afghanistan, and the so-called rise of China. But some human rights activists here and around the world are calling for questions on the administration's increasing use of drones to carry out targeted killings. FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Neither presidential candidate has spoken in depth about the CIA's drone program, which has killed hundreds of suspected militants and civilians in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Somalia. President Obama and his appointed officials have defended the program in interviews and speeches as constitutional and strategically important in the battle against terrorist groups. But some human rights experts, including Columbia Law School professor Noreen Shah, say both Obama and Romney should be pressed further in the final debate.
I think they have to answer for the fact that other countries are going to be acquiring this technology, and the U.S. is setting the example. It's setting the precedent. It's the first country that's using drone technology in this secretive way to strike people, to kill people, and it hasn't yet defined the limits of what it's doing. So if we're going to be setting an example for the rest of the world, they need to answer for what kind of example that's going to be.
Shaw led a study released earlier this month that shows that the most cited organizations tracking deaths from drone strikes, including the Long War Journal and the New America Foundation, greatly underestimate the number of civilians killed. The motivating factors to this discrepancy, she says, are restrictions on journalists in drone strike areas, the motives of local officials interviewed, and U.S. government secrecy.
We don't know how many strikes there have been. The U.S. government won't explain whether it's the CIA that's conducting strikes or U.S. Special Forces or some combination of the two. President Obama hasn't gone on national TV to explain why it's necessary to send drones to Somalia and Yemen, why we should be in those parts of the world, even if we're only there remotely with unmanned planes.
The Columbia Human Rights Clinic's report calls on the next U.S. president to investigate civilian deaths, track and release drone strike casualty information, and disclose the criteria used to target people. The next president may also have an even bigger secret arsenal at his disposal. Citing unnamed officials, The Washington Post recently reported a request from the CIA for 10 more drones on top of the more than 30 the agency already operates. Over the weekend, outgoing Ohio Congressmember Dennis Kucinich made a statement accusing the CIA of trying to become a paramilitary force and said he would oppose the purchase unless the agency first conducts a public review of the drone program.
Are drones necessary? Are they wise? Do they make a bad situation even worse? Lacking a national intelligence estimate, approval of the request for more drones would be tantamount to doubling down on the dismissal of international law.
Some human rights advocates abroad agree with Kucinich that the strikes violate international law. Islamabad-based attorney Shahzad Akbar is bringing several lawsuits to courts in Pakistan on behalf of drone strike victims and their families. FSRN spoke to Akbar about these cases when he visited the U.S. this spring.
First of all, we have some homicide murder cases registered against CIA officials who were working in Pakistan on this. Then we have cases in High Court of Peshawar, where we're challenging Pakistani government involvement in this and the intelligence agencies, and then also the failure of government to protect the life of their own citizens.
In the first case, Akbar is representing 45-year-old reporter Karim Khan, who says the CIA's Jonathan Banks and John Rizzo are responsible for killing his son and brother in a 2009 drone strike. The second case involves charges against Pakistani officials on behalf of eight people who lost family members in a 2011 strike. They say their right to life under Pakistan's constitution was violated and that intrusions into the country's airspace should be seen as acts of war. A judge in Islamabad is set to rule this week on whether the case against the CIA officials can go forward. If it does, a Pakistani magistrate would call on Interpol to issue an international warrant for their arrest. Alice Olstein, FSRN, Washington.
While the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan has been repeated throughout the presidential campaigns, many issues have been left out of the discussion. It's America's longest-running war and has claimed thousands of U.S. and Afghan lives and billions of dollars. Nearly 500,000 residents are displaced inside Afghanistan, and the UN Refugee Agency expects 400 to 800,000 refugees to return in the coming year. For more on the U.S. war in Afghanistan and what the presidential candidates should address, we go to Marine veteran Andres Reyes. Reyes was on active duty in the Marines for 8 years and served both in Afghanistan and Iraq. He joins us by phone from Bridgeport, Connecticut. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you for having me.
Where did you serve in Afghanistan?
Well, I was with the 3rd Battalion, 3rd Marines, and I was my home base was at the FOB Salerno back in 2004 to the beginning of 2005, and it was in the coast province of Afghanistan.
And you also served in Iraq?
Yes, I did in 2006, another 8-month deployment.
And how has your experience there shaped your view of the war?
Before you go, you know, as an 18, at the time I was 18-year-old private PFC, and you know, you're kind of shaped into what the commanders are saying. It's always, especially in the infantry, it's always a need to know basis thing where you just don't really need to know a lot of the politics. Well, when you get over there, you kind of see what's going on, and a lot of times all it was really interacting with the populace, always asking them where the quote unquote bad guy was. And treating them like the bad guys, they didn't give us the answers that we wanted. A lot of times, the majority of the firefight that we got into was between two feuding tribes. And when you hear the real reason, you know, that we were between the two feuding tribes, and, you know, we're in there, we're getting shot at, but we're kind of in a an environment that we shouldn't even be at in the beginning. So then the commanders, of course, blame the tribes for fighting, for trying to kill you. But it's really not that, you know.
In these debates so far, all of the candidates have commended the valor, the sacrifice of troops. Vice President Joe Biden called taking care of troops the country's one sacred obligation. Talk about the cost on returning soldiers, either with mental health issues or physical injuries. Talk about the legacies of Afghanistan.
Veterans today, we're the number one of the homeless, like one of the number one homeless populations. You know, the majority is veterans. You know, the suicide rate for veterans, it's up to, and I don't know the exact numbers, but last time I heard it was like 18 a day. And these are topics that these politicians refuse to address. We have 800,000, almost a million, 200,000 away from a million claims at the VA waiting to get approved for health benefits. And then when you go to the VA and you ask for assistance or something like that, it's they give you this pill and they give you that pill to dope you out. They tell you to wait. They tell you to sit down. So the transition for a lot of service members to come back is extremely, extremely difficult. It's a huge struggle, and that's the horrible thing about it. Everyone refuses to address the issues with mental health issues with the veterans. They refuse to address the homeless issue with veterans, and that's the way. That's both parties. It goes both ways with them.
Andres Reyes, military veteran from Afghanistan and Iraq. The Afghan war is the longest in U.S. history. More than 2,000 U.S. soldiers have died, about 18,000 wounded. What would you like to hear from the presidential candidates in tonight's debate about Afghanistan?
I'd like to hear about why they think it is necessary to continue to kill civilians overseas. I want to know why they refuse to address the topic of veterans and their veterans' mental health, veterans' benefits. I want them to answer the question of why they feel that if a service member wants to not fight and decides that they want to become a conscientious objector, why they strip military veterans of that caliber of their their benefits, you know, their compensation, and I just want them to address the overall issues that these war is causing with veterans and service members coming home. That's the main thing.
Andres Reyes is a Marine veteran. He served in Iraq and Afghanistan. He joined us by phone from Connecticut. Andres Reyes, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you for having me, and I appreciate you guys listening to me.
Voters in Maine, Washington, Minnesota, and Maryland will decide on same-sex marriage initiatives in the upcoming general elections. In Maryland, a ballot referendum could overturn a same-sex marriage law passed in the legislature earlier this year. Marriage equality advocates are looking to the state to break a losing streak that has seen similar measures shot down by popular vote in 32 other states. FSRN's Clayton Kahn reports.
This past March, Maryland became the seventh state to legalize same-sex marriage after lawmakers narrowly voted to pass the bill known as the Civil Marriage Protection Act. However, opponents of the bill gathered more than double the necessary amount of signatures to force it to a referendum vote in the upcoming November elections. Known as Question 6, the ballot measure has reached a high-profile status as opponents and supporters have brought in celebrities and notable politicians to aggressively campaign. For supporter and Johns Hopkins University academic administrator Mike Bernard, it simply boils down to a question of equality. He says he just wants all couples to have equal rights.
My husband and I have been together almost 20 years. We've committed to ceremonies in 1994, and we got our legal marriage license in 2008. But we'd like to have that freedom to marry for all Marylanders, so we don't have to go far away to get a marriage license.
Bernard says gay and lesbian couples who do not receive the same kinds of economic benefits as do married heterosexual couples face challenges in everyday issues, from taxes to raising a child.
But there are some practical issues in the areas of fairness and equality. I mean, certain tax benefits we do not have that straight married couples do. That extra money could go to paying for the kids' education, you know, buying school supplies, getting them school clothes, things like that, putting money toward their college education.
Like Bernard, many supporters view the fight for marriage equality as a fight for civil rights. This sentiment gained strong endorsements this past May when President Obama and the NAACP both came out to publicly express their support. However, opponents such as Maggie Gallagher, founder of the National Organization of Marriage, point to previous court cases to defend their claim that marriage equality is not an issue of civil rights.
Gay marriage is not a civil right, it's a civil wrong. I could go to the words of the Maryland Supreme Court, which just a few years back specifically rejected the idea that defining marriage as one man and one woman represents unjust discrimination.
Although opponents to marriage equality have convinced voters to deny its passage in every previous referendum vote throughout the country, supporters such as Reverend Meredith Moise, co-chair of Baltimore Black Pride, say that overall public opinion is shifting to support same-sex marriage as more lesbian and gay couples continue to come out.
Gay people are not going to go away. Lesbians are not going to go away. We are having families. We are developing significant relationships. And at the end of the day, we are human beings. And people being able to see our humanity will change this country forever.
For Moise and other supporters, passage of the same-sex marriage ballot measure will be a watershed moment that will fuel further dialogue about rights and equality for the LGBTQ community in the state and beyond.
In fact, I think that when the bill passes and people get used to the idea of same-gender couples being able to marry, it will fuel more and more conversation about the lives of gay and lesbian people, particularly the lives of gay and lesbians of color. And I'm hoping that this will open up a dialogue which will really help people see the humanity of their neighbors, their friends, and their loved ones.
Marylanders for Marriage Equality, the main group supporting the measure, has raised $3.3 million to defend the bill, four times the amount than the leading opponent organization, Maryland Marriage Alliance, who has pulled in about $840,000, according to the nonpartisan research organization MapLate. Supporters also received a boost this past week when two of their largest individual donors, New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Republican billionaire Paul Singer, both donated $250,000. If Maryland voters uphold the bill through referendum vote, It will go into effect in January 2013. Clayton Kahn, FSRN, Baltimore.
All of us here at Free Speech Radio News want to say thank you for your support during our most recent fund drive. FSRN airs grassroots reporting from around the world, and we depend on grassroots support from listeners like you. Thank you, and visit us anytime at fsrn.org. Activist and linguist Noam Chomsky visited the Gaza Strip over the weekend. He attended an international conference at the Islamic University of Gaza. FSRN's Rami Almagari sat down with Chomsky to discuss strategies to end the Israeli blockade on Gaza. He began by asking Chomsky's views on calls for an academic boycott of Israeli institutions.
So in the case of South Africa, for example, which I was involved in the boycotts, they were highly selective. And they were selected in a way which would lead to help for the victims, not to make us feel good, help for the victims. The same in the case of, say, the Vietnam War. I was in prison many times. I was involved in civil disobedience, organizing resistance, and so on. But we always had to ask ourselves, when we pick a particular tactic, what does it mean for the Vietnamese? Not what does it mean for us? And sometimes there are things that you should do, sometimes there are things you shouldn't do. And in fact, they were very helpful in that regard. I could give you details if you like. And the same is true with boycotts. So an academic, if you call for an academic boycott of, say, Tel Aviv University, you have to ask yourself what the consequences are of that call for the Palestinians. And there's an indirect answer. When you carry out an act, say, in the United States, you're trying to reach the American population, and you're trying to bring the American population to be more supportive of Palestinian rights and opposed to Israeli and U.S. policies. So you therefore ask yourself, will an academic boycott of Tel Aviv University you ask yourself what the effect would be on the audience in the United States that you're trying to reach. Now, that depends on the amount of organization and education that has taken place in the United States. Today, if you look at people's understanding and beliefs, a call for an academic boycott on Tel Aviv University will strengthen support for Israel and U.S. policy because it's not understood. There's no point talking to people in Swahili if they don't understand what you're saying. There could be circumstances in which a boycott of Tel Aviv would be helpful, but first you have to do the educational and organizational work. Same with South Africa. They began really around 1980. There were a few before, but mainly around then. That was after 20 years of serious organizing and activism, which had led to a situation in which there was almost universal opposition to apartheid. Corporations were pulling out following the Sullivan Law. Congress was passing sanctions. The UN had already declared an embargo. We're nowhere near that in the case of Palestine.
President Abbas has called for the United Nations to recognize Palestine as a non-member state of the UN. What do you think about this move amidst Israel's ongoing unilateral actions on the ground that change facts or deform facts on the ground?
The question is whether this act will improve the situation of the Palestinians. It's independent of what Israel's doing on the ground, that separate issues. Abbas can't change what Israel's doing on the ground. He can, or Palestinians can, take steps which will improve their situation in the international arena. So we ask ourselves, will a move towards recognition of Palestine in a non-observer status be of benefit to the Palestinians or not? Well, I think it could be of some benefit. For example, it could set up, there's a good reason why the U.S. and Israel are so passionately opposed to it. The reason they're passionately opposed is that it would be of benefit to the Palestinians. For example, it would give them the status in which they might consider bringing criminal charges against Israel to the International Criminal Court. Now, that's not almost certainly not going to succeed, but it could be an important educational step. And those are the things you think about if you care about the victims. As I said, if you don't care about the victims, you don't ask these questions. In this case, I think it can have some mild positive effect. And we should pay attention to the fact that the U.S. and Israel are passionately opposed. If they're passionately opposed, we should ask ourselves why. And they're opposed precisely because it could be of benefit to the Palestinians.
Which is rather workable, two-state solution or one democratic state solution? Which is rather workable?
They're not a choice. It's not a choice. I've been in favor of what's called a one-state solution, a binational state, for 70 years. I'm in favor of it. But if you know, I'm also in favor of peace in the world. But to say I'm in favor of getting rid of poverty, you know, a lot of things I'm in favor of. But if you're serious, you say, how do we get from here to there? You know, that's the question. We can all say, yes, it's a wonderful idea. In fact, I don't even think a one state is a good idea. I think there should be a no state solution. They should erode the imperial borders. There's no reason to worship French and British decisions on where to draw borders. So a no-state solution would be much better. But again, we ask, how do we get there? And as far as I know, today, there have been, over the years, over the 70 years I've been involved in it, there have been different ways in which you could move to that direction. Circumstances change, so your tactics change. Under current circumstances, in fact, since 1975, there's only one way that has ever been proposed, at least that I'm aware of, and that's in stages. Through a two-state solution as the first stage. If there's another way, nobody's told us.
That's author, historian, and linguist Noam Chomsky speaking to FSRN's Rami Almagari in Gaza City. Longtime politician, World War II veteran, and anti-war advocate George McGovern died on Sunday at the age of 90. The liberal U.S. senator from South Dakota challenged Richard Nixon in the 1972 presidential election. Nixon won in a landslide, but McGovern continued a lifetime of political work dedicated to social causes. In 2010, he spoke to WORT's Norm Stockwell about U.S. military spending.
I happen to believe that what we're doing in Afghanistan is not going to improve the defense of this country one iota. It's going to weaken us as a country because it's so expensive, and we need those financial resources, our tax money. We need that for other purposes that are more crucial to our national security than a doubtful, debatable war in the mountains of Afghanistan.
In addition to his anti-war advocacy, McGovern spent decades working on eradicating hunger. He was director of the Food for Peace program started under President John F. Kennedy and helped in creating the UN's World Food Program. According to his family, McGovern continued writing, giving speeches, and advising until this past summer. And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Kopp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.